Welcome back to the Decarb Connect podcast. And I think some of my listeners will remember that I had been on a bit of a mission to try and find some stories from outside of Europe, outside of North America, where so many of our podcast episodes have been centred. And today, I'm very pleased to say that Bruno Fuchs, who is the Director of EcoCycle and Sustainability for Siam City Cement in Vietnam, has joined me. So this is a really, really interesting opportunity to explore how some of our harder to abate sectors are already making moves and getting active, even without some of the incentives or tax pushes that are evident in other regions. So Bruno, thank you so much for being willing to have a chat. Looking forward to hearing what you're up to at Siam City Cement.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Alex, for the invitation. I'm very excited about this podcast as well myself.
Great. Well, look, we'll do the usual. And the usual for me is that I ask my guests to talk about how they've arrived at this point in time. And what I'm interested in, I suppose, with you is three things. There's the personal and the professional driver that's got you into this sustainability role, but also clearly from your accent, we can hear that you are Swiss or were originally from Switzerland. You're now based in Vietnam. So tell us a little bit about all of those factors.
Sure. Yeah. So yeah, you caught it right. I'm originally from Switzerland. I grew up in a very small village in the Swiss Alps. Was very fortunate. Had a lovely childhood there. Very close to nature, obviously. So I think that's why I was always attracted to sustainability, etc. You know, that time we got our meat, we got from the local farmer. We played hours and hours in the forest. So I think nature is very close to my heart. Professionally, I had the pleasure to work for Holcim at very early in my career, actually just after university. I joined Holcim and I've been working there in the sustainability field. So that's now almost 20 years. And that's why I'm, you know, very attracted to sustainability. Yeah. And yes, you're right. Now I'm based here in Vietnam, in Ho Chi Minh. So quite a bit of a difference from a 200 people village in the Swiss mountains to a 10 million city in Asia, but enjoying it a lot. And obviously, yes, there's a lot to do here when it comes to sustainability. And yes, I think we will explore a little bit more in the next half an hour on what we as a company are doing here. Yeah.
And out of interest, when you joined Holcim, what was the background you brought with you? Had you been doing chemical engineering? Had you done something else? What was it that brought you into cement as an industry?
Very interesting. No, I didn't have any chemical background or so. So I have a master in management. And during my studies, I did a lot of internships in Holcim at that time and various departments. I did everything what you can imagine. I spent one summer in the lab. I spent one summer in the commercial event management, etc. So I had a bit of an insight into the company, but when I finished my studies, there was just an opening in the sustainability department as a business analyst. So really analyzing data about how the company is doing. And that's how I got into this field. Yeah.
Right. Well, that's kind of an unusual actually for our podcast, because we find so often that people have come into sustainability or decarbonization either from technology background, an engineering background or whatever. So you are 100% sustainability. So great. That's a good background with which to head into our conversation. So as I mentioned at the beginning in the intro, I mean, the interest in talking to you is partly doing sustainability in cement, but it's also partly about where you are located and where you are doing this work. So perhaps for our listeners who are based in all kinds of regions around the world, could you give us a bit of a state of play for Vietnam? You know, what's the reality in terms of the government formal or informal discussions and targets? And obviously you're in a very different region from in terms of the policy drivers that may be in place. So just, yeah, give us that overview so we know before you talk what we're working with in context.
Sure. So, I mean, maybe to start with, at the COP26, the Vietnamese prime minister as well made the commitment to be net zero by 2050. So I think this was a big commitment for the country. A country which is obviously still in a developing phase. I mean, it's still a development country. I would say a lot of industry still building up, as well a country where the population, GDP, et cetera, is still growing. It has a very young population, 100 million though. So we have 100 million people here, so it's not a small country. And I think a big challenge, obviously, to achieve this net zero by 2050, if you imagine that you still want to grow and to bring new industry in, et cetera, et cetera. But I think the direction is very clear. And I think there were as well some initiatives afterwards, after this commitment, that clearly shows that the country wants to achieve that. So, for example, the new Power Development Plan 8 has been issued, and there you can clearly see a shift from coal, from fossil fuels, more into renewable. So I think the trajectory and the objective and the direction there as well, very clear. As well, there has been a new environmental protection law issued recently. EPR, extended producer responsibility, has been as well kicked off this year, 1st of January 2024. So you see a lot of activities that are ongoing. I think the biggest challenge that I see for the country as such is, how do you enforce this? How do you put this in place? And really do it as well at the level playing field, so that everybody is really kind of impacted and in the same way. And there I see a little bit of a challenge. We see it as well now with this EPR law, which on paper is very straightforward. But then there are still a lot of questions around implementation, enforcement, etc. So I think the willingness is definitely there, and some clear actions as well. But how to, ensure the enforcement of new regulations and laws, I think that is one of the biggest challenge that I see.
And EPR in particular, what are the headlines of what that means for you? What sorts of things are you having to think about as a result of that coming into force?
So the extended producer responsibility basically really, forces some of the producers, multinational companies here, to take care of, for example, more recycling. When we are talking about packaging, plastics, there's a certain amount, percentage that you need to recycle. If you don't do that, you have to either, if you don't do it yourself, you have to find another company who's recycling, for example, plastic, or you have to pay into an EPR fund, kind of a penalty, if you're not able to recycle this. And this is a good example. So I think when I talk to multinational companies, which are our customers, and even us, as a multinational company, we actually don't mind, for example, to pay into a fund if we don't have the ability to, say, recycle the packaging ourselves, or nobody else is there. But what is not clear today is what is happening with this fund. Is this fund really used to develop new recycling capacities, or is this used for something else? And there is no clear answer. And even if you talk to the responsible authorities, you don't really get a clear answer. And I think these are some of the question marks which are behind of that particular loan. As I said, it started 1st of January this year. So obviously, we will see as we go along and towards the end of the year how this really plays out.
Okay, well, we've established a little bit of the kind of reality on the ground. What one final question around that for now, and then we'll move more into what you are doing. Obviously, you have former colleagues based in Europe, and I'm sure elsewhere around the world, who are sitting in countries or regions that have other forms of policy, other forms of incentives, other forms of carrots and sticks, you know. So when you look at what's driving them forward? What's different for you? You know, what do you see? Obviously, there isn't a carbon tax, and I understand that, but what does that mean for the difference in how you need to look at things, do you think?
So, I mean, you're correct. It's a bit more difficult, I would say, maybe to have this self-motivation or self-initiative from the companies, but as well from individual people to be more sustainable. But I think as well, when I talk here to many multinational companies, they have their own global policies, right? When I talk to Unilever or so, they have their own global policies. So, which means, you know, whatever they have to do in Europe, when it comes, let's say, to waste management or water management, these kind of things, they have to follow these interim policies as well here, even if the law and regulations are not forcing them. And I think these are some very good drivers as well to lift a little bit industry standards to show as well what is possible, even in a country where you maybe not have all the infrastructure for waste treatment, what water treatment, et cetera, available. But I think these countries are as well pushing, these companies are as well pushing that this comes in place. And I think Vietnam as a country is as well realizing if you want to attract FDIs, if you want to attract more multinational companies, you actually have to provide them with certain infrastructure, huh? Because the companies can simply not afford to, you know, be sustainable in Europe and here just do whatever they want, not caring about the environment and so on. And I think there were some very successful FDI attractions into Vietnam. So LEGO is just building their first carbon neutral factory here for $1 billion, and this is progressing well. And obviously, you know, they need as well a certain infrastructure around to make sure that, you know, they can produce carbon neutral and that they have the access to waste management, water treatment, and renewable energy and all the like. So I think it's a bit more difficult if you don't have these official laws and regulations, but still I think there are individual players who have the self-motivation or maybe some pressure from their headquarters in more developed countries to still sustainably developing there.
Okay, well, let's turn our attention then to Siam City Cement itself. Talk us through your actual, you know, the targets or the plan. You know, how do you focus on sustainability and decarbonization, given that that's the context in which you're operating?
Yeah, so obviously being in the cement industry, I think the biggest concern when it comes to sustainable development is our CO2 emissions. So we are a CO2 intensive industry. And as you said, we don't have any CO2 tax or carbon trading system in place here in Vietnam or even in the region here in Southeast Asia. So there is less of a, you know, force there pushing us to do more. However, we as give some background as well of being part of Holcim in the past. I think we all have a little bit of a sustainability DNA. And I think we would like to do the right thing that is in there. And I think this is as well our responsibility as an industry leader to really push what we can do in terms of sustainable development. At Siam City Cement, we developed our SD 2030 ambition in 2020. So 3 years ago, we came together and we defined, okay, what are the most important points when it comes to sustainable development? And obviously, the energy emissions, so CO2 is one of it, but we are not limiting to that. We looked then as well into circular economy. So what can we do in terms of waste management, in terms of using byproducts from other industries for our products? We looked into biodiversity and water as well, very important in this region here. And then we as well defined what do we do with regards to health and safety and to community engagement. So we basically took by 2020, we said that's the baseline in 2020, where are we? And then we developed an ambition by 2030 to say what do we would like to achieve in these fields that I mentioned. And then we have broken this down into roadmaps, yearly roadmaps for each country. And so Vietnam has a roadmap how to achieve the ambition 2030, Thailand has it, Cambodia has it, etc. And we are tracking this obviously on a yearly basis at least, and we are as well communicating this to our stakeholders. But we have developed as well a quarterly reporting mechanism internally just to check whether we're really on track. Are there any bottlenecks, or are there any good practices, best practices that we can as well share across the countries? We are a small player. We are only in 5 countries, but nevertheless, just this engagement with these 5 countries always brings some new ideas what one country is doing, and maybe the other can multiply and adapt. And so I think that's quite fruitful, yeah.
And I mean, I understand, those, because you're not tied to an SBTI, for example, they may not be public, but are they specific, as in about tonnage reductions or emissions? Or I know you have other categories as well, or is it more about percentage changes, or how have you framed those targets for yourself?
Yeah. So for CO2, for example, we have a specific target in terms of CO2 emissions per ton of product that we would like to achieve. So we set it for 2030, we would like to have this below 470 kilogram per ton of product. So compared to 2020, that's a reduction of 25%. So that's, I would say, is significant for us. Maybe some might challenge this a little bit. Can you not do more? I think it's rather challenging. And as well, for example, on this CO2, we only put the target until 2030. We deliberately didn't make any commitment to 2050 yet, because we as a management team, as a leadership team, thought, okay, let's commit to something that we as an existing management team can influence somehow. I hope by 2050 I will not be here anymore. So by 2030, I still believe, all the actions that we are doing right now and in the coming years, I think we can be accountable for and we can be responsible for. So that's why we didn't go beyond 2030. And similar to the other measures that I mentioned, so for example, in circular economy, we made as well a commitment that by 2030, we will treat every year at least 1.4 million tons of waste material and produce an alternative fuel out of it. So again, this is rather significant growth from where we were in 2020, but very measurable. And again, we have to track this and we have to report this every year to our stakeholders. Similar for water as well, very specific target that we say we would like to reduce the specific water consumption by at least 20%. And we would like to increase as well the surface water usage to above 40% of all water that we are using. On biodiversity, we have a net positive impact commitment by 2030. And there we are working together with other stakeholders, with IUCN, with other experts who help us to say, okay, how can we achieve this kind of target? So I would say for each of these categories, we have very specific targets which are measurable, which are traceable, and we have as well a lot of initiatives behind this to make sure that we can achieve it at the end.
I just want to take this opportunity to thank our production partner and sponsor, Jano Media, for their support in delivering the Decarb Connect podcast. Over the last few years, they've helped us to facilitate great conversations that connect us with our audience, and their skills and expertise mean that we get to concentrate exclusively on generating the content, the conversations that engage, inform, and inspire. Well, let's pick up on some of those initiatives. So I'm sure there's a number of things that you have either in motion or in plans. And let's think, if we can, specifically around the emissions and the circularity aspects, just because it sort of lends itself more to what we typically talk about here at Decarb. What are some of the projects or approaches that you're most proud of that are either in action or are now plans that are about to be deployed? What would you point to? Again, just for the leader, for the reader, listener, sorry, to remember the context of less policy support means this is mostly self-generated activity. So what would you identify as the things that are really, you're proud of them, and they're the things that are going to make the difference?
Yeah. So when it comes to CO2 emissions, I think we are applying two key levers to reduce them. One is we reduce the use of fossil fuels. So in the production of cement, you need a lot of energy. You need a lot of thermal energy, and that typically comes from fossil fuels. But we are trying to reduce and replace this fossil fuel with waste-derived materials, waste-derived fuels. And here in Vietnam, for example, we are replacing today about 40% of the thermal energy with waste-derived materials. So that really helps on one hand to reduce our environmental footprint as a company, but on the other hand, it helps as well to solve a waste problem which is really imminent in Vietnam. Because in Vietnam, 80% of all the waste today is still going into landfill. And there, obviously, you make not use of the resource. Plus, in addition, you have the issue of other greenhouse gas emissions, methane emissions, etc. So by using this waste and transforming it into an alternative fuels, we really can solve kind of two problems simultaneously. So, for example, last year we treated about 160,000 tons of waste that otherwise most likely would end up into a landfill. And this 160,000 tons of waste helped us to replace 40% of our fossil fuels. That means as well we need to use less fossil fuels, need to less mining of it, etc. So I think that's something I'm very proud of. And again, we are not there at the end. We would like to push more. We would like to replace even higher amounts of fossil fuels. So there are as well actions in there in terms of investments that we need to do, etc., to push this further. On the other hand, the other big factor in terms of CO2 reduction per ton of product is that we reduce the clinker factor of our end product, of our cement. And here as well, in Vietnam, as an example, we are already today, we are around 58% clinker factor, means another 40% is coming from byproducts, and that is across all our product portfolio. However, we have some cement products that are using 45 percent clinker and 55% byproducts. These byproducts, again, they're coming from other industries, from the steel industry, power industries, so this could be fly ashes, slags, and other material. And again, here, I think this is one contribution to a circular economy because we really can use one byproduct from another industry in our product. And again, with the benefit of reducing the CO2 emissions per ton of product that we are having. And here again, we would like to push further. Sometimes there, the issue is maybe on regulation on the market, because maybe the specifications for certain products are higher, and then you need to have a certain clinker factor in there. So it needs a lot of different stakeholders as well that need to be aligned into there.
So I'm thinking as you're talking that when we talk to steel, cement, glass, chem, you know, those kind of heavy emitting manufacturers in Europe and in North America, these are projects they're also doing, but they also have the ability to at least put in applications for incentives and support for other kind of very early stage disruptive technology, whether that's in the hydrogen space or carbon capture or CO2 reuse. What's the reality around that for you? Like, I mean, I totally understand that there are not government incentives for that in your region. Are there any kind of partners that could support with those projects, or are those kind of, well, those are super distant, Alex, and we just can't even think about it right now. What's the reality of some of those kind of deep decarbonization technologies for you?
Yeah, I think the reality, how I see it, it will take a few more years until this really comes here into the region. And I think really because we don't have this driving force, let's say, for example, from the regulator, or not even from our customers, to be honest, it's a little bit sad, huh? But for example, we are the first company in the region that have an EPD, Environmental Product Declaration, for all our products. Already since 3 years. So people could actually really see what is the, you know, the footprint, carbon footprint of each product. But to be frank, most of our customers don't really care too much. There are really only a few projects. For example, the Lego factory that I mentioned, I mean, they definitely care. Huh? They would like to make sure that whatever product they're using to build it, is very transparent, has the lowest possible environmental footprint, etc. But other than that, again, very punctual that you see some of the projects are really looking to the, for this, and some of the customers looking for this. So as well here, we don't really see, let's say, the pull from our customers. So there's no pull from the customers, there's no push from the regulator. However, I still believe whatever we are doing, on one hand, I think makes us more competitive as well today already. And I believe there is no other way than a sustainable way as well in the future. So sooner or later, these, let's say, regulations, CO2 trading, etc., will come as well into this region here. And then I believe that we as a company will have an advantage because we already developed these things. We're already starting at a much more developed baseline, I would say. And then hopefully we can somehow leverage this and as well put this into a competitive advantage for us. And by the
So,
way, I mean, yeah.
sorry, I was going to say, as a leadership team, then, so are you sort of sensing that there will be a day where there will be more requirement to perform in this way? And so that, because my question to you was going to be, well, what's the competitive advantage if other people don't have to do this right now? But I guess your point is you're building a platform that's going to get you ahead when those things do come into the region. Is
Exactly.
that the sense?
So exactly. I mean, for sure it will come. There is no doubt. And I think it has to come, especially, for example, if you put the net zero commitment from the Prime Minister in Vietnam into perspective. And again, Vietnam has a very strong cement industry. And so it's the third largest worldwide, actually. Not many people know this, but you have the third largest capacity in Vietnam. So if you want to achieve, this net zero for the country, I mean, that's definitely one industry that you have to look into. But again, it will probably take some time. There are some talks about a CO2 trading system that should start around 2028. Again, this is, I think, very ambitious because there is no baseline yet here, right? I mean, if you need CO2 emission data, etc., I mean, it's not collected in a structured way. So I think it might take a little bit longer, but for sure it will come. And as you said, at that time we will be ready as a company to be at the forefront in there. But the other thing that we always say as well is, I mean, we should do what we believe is the right thing. And even though there is no pressure, etc., I mean, if we have the possibility to reduce our environmental footprint, to reduce water consumption, to increase biodiversity value, I mean, why we shouldn't do it? And for sure, some of this will need an investment, but we believe as well that there will be a return of this investment in there.
So I know you mentioned earlier that one of the big kind of pushes for government in Vietnam is around expanding renewables. It'd be kind of useful, I suppose, to have a look at what kind of renewable energy is possible in the country and in the region you're dealing with. And my follow-on question from that is, I know, we do talk to clients who are really interested in the possibility of long-duration energy storage as a way of really grabbing that renewable opportunity for higher heat applications or for, process-led industries that need it always on. So tell us a little bit about that. What is the nature of the renewables? Is it something you think you're going to be able to tap into more? And is long-duration energy storage something you're considering yet? Or is that a bit far off?
So with regards to renewables, I think Vietnam has still a lot of potential for sure. It actually had a fantastic growth in solar energy about 3 years back. I mean, really amazing. You see a lot of rooftop solar, etc. It then a little bit came to a halt, and there was again a lot of discussions more from a regulatory framework about how to deal with private how to deal with when you would like to put this energy into the grid, etc. So very a lot of uncertainties that were in there. So it really came to a halt. And again, now it seems that it will be picking up again the discussions, and there should be some more certainty as well for the investors in that. The other big opportunity is wind energy, so onshore and offshore. So Vietnam has a huge coastal line and a lot of potential in there. We see a lot of wind farms already today, but they have been built as well few years back, and now there's not a lot of new development actually happening in there. And again, this is all linked to the, let's say, uncertainty from a regulatory framework that is given at the moment. I think once this is there, I mean, once there is a, you know, kind of a plannable future for the investor, I think there is a huge potential, and it's in the interest of the country to give this certainty to the investors. And I'm confirmed, convinced that this will come pretty soon. Now, for us, again, we looked as well into solar. We have our partner company in Cambodia. They have a solar farm, and they are providing a lot of electricity from their solar energy themselves. When we looked here in Vietnam into this, again, we were facing some, I would say, rather ridiculous legal issues that we had in there. Because if you put a solar farm on your factory land, basically you have to change the land use right. Because when we bought this land 30 years back, we didn't put in that we will build a solar farm. We just put in, well, we will produce clinker and cement in there. So, and to change the land use right is rather complicated in here. I mean, this is just an example of some of the regulatory roadblocks that we are facing. But nevertheless, we continue to look into this, and I'm pretty sure if many more companies are looking into this as well, and maybe, you know, advocating, lobbying the regulators, then this will change as well in favor of putting in more renewable energy in there.
Well, I mean, in any region, in investment relies on investor confidence, doesn't it? And I mean, even in, I don't know, US at the moment, certainly in the UK, you know, even though we have policy in place, that the sense that that policy can shift and ebb and flow, you know, creates its own issues, even in countries that have that framework in place. What's your feel for investor confidence or the ability to sort of draw in investment to pursue more of these kind of projects for companies like yours? Is there a good degree of confidence yet, or is it still quite challenging to get private investment or private investors to kind of consider some of the things that you're looking at?
Yeah, I think the confidence is actually increasing recently. There are some, let's say, positive points that Vietnam can deliver. On one hand, it has a very stable political environment. So that is one of the advantages. The other is obviously as well, yes, GDP growth, etc., is really there. And as well, you have a relatively young population, a lot of young people who can be educated, and you can get as a workforce in there. So I see the FDIs into Vietnam have been increasing a lot, especially as well in the first quarter this year, and as well end of last year. We had a little bit of a downturn due to COVID, as many other countries as well. And I think it took a bit longer here to get back the confidence. But now, when I see some of the questionnaires and the surveys that I've been doing, for example, by Eurocham, etc., you see a lot of companies are really increasing again their confidence, and they are ready to invest into China, into Vietnam. Why I mixed up Vietnam and China, just wanted to say, we see still a lot of companies who in the past produced in China who are moving now to Vietnam. So this is an has been ongoing for many, many years already, and still ongoing. So I think many of the multinational companies would like to diversify as well a little bit the locations, the manufacturing portfolio where they are. And we see a lot of companies who are moving from China into Vietnam. And then, as I said, as well, a lot of other multinational companies who have been choosing Vietnam as an investment opportunity. So I think this is all positive. And I hope that if the government really can as well provide some more and infrastructure, sustainable environment in there, it will be even more successful.
Okay, well, last question from me. You mean you've already mentioned that there's not a demand pull from customers for, for this kind of work or for lower carbon product. But how, I mean, do you have, is part of the sustainability plan to work with customers or maybe to push it back up to suppliers? How do you view in activity terms rather than philosophical terms, I guess, what's your role in that, do you think, right now, given that you're an early adopter for the region, aren't you, in doing this kind of work? So talk to me about how you see that role in the supply chain, in the value chain, sorry.
No, very good. I mean, we as an individual company, we don't have a lot of impact as such. So we definitely need to work together with other stakeholders. In INSEE, we do very specific activities. So for example, we organize so-called coffee talks when we talk about ESG, sustainability, sustainable development, etc. And there we invite other companies, for example, architects who talk about sustainable construction. We invite developers who are developing new sustainable projects in there. And like this, we would like to exchange the information and raise the awareness as well among the whole value chain. And as such, really then try to really push this topic forward. And I think we only can be successful if we are working together across the whole value chain. If a developer doesn't know about sustainable construction, and if the architect doesn't know about it, if we are not able to convince others that our products are, more sustainable, then we will not succeed. But if all work together and if all have the same understanding and the awareness, I think then we really can push the things forward. And another initiative that we are having, which I'm quite proud of, is the INSEE Prize. So this is a competition kind of that we organize on a yearly basis, where students can propose their new ideas about sustainable construction, sustainable development, etc. And we do this for 15 years already. Last year we had about 200 projects that have been proposed in the first round. Then you have a semi-final and you have a final, and then the winning project actually gets to be implemented as far as we can. So we are supporting the implementation with a little bit of money from our side. And if the money is not sufficient, we try to get some other sponsors who are interested in developing a sustainable project. And then together with the students, we are implementing this project. So I think this is as well, these are not big projects, but these are small ones. Nevertheless, I think these are important showcases. And then hopefully, if we can multiply these smaller projects and have more of them, and maybe in the future, bigger projects like this, then we will have as well a bigger impact when it comes to sustainable development.
It's preparing the ground, isn't it? That's what those sorts of initiatives do, is prepare the ground so that when further regulation or further policy or a bigger push or whatever, comes to the region, there are so many more people that are already bought in and ready to support. So really interesting. Well, Bruno, thank you so much for spending some time, because I'm really aware with Decarb Connect that we are very, very Northern Hemisphere focused. And while there are, of course, challenges in the regions that we typically serve, I think it's just really interesting to hear what is possible, even without the frameworks and without the supporting or driving factors that perhaps we see in Europe and the US and Canada. So thank you. Thanks for sharing what you've been doing. And really interesting to talk with you.
Thank you very much, Alex, as well, and keep up the great work you're doing at Decarb.
Thank you.
At Jano Media, we recognize that great content has the power to create impactful and positive change for lives and society. Whether that's video, live streams, photography, or podcasts, partnering with us will enable you to harness the power of content to engage, inform, and inspire. Reach out to us today.